This episode of Talking Shop Down Under is brought to you by DDD Melbourne, the best developer event you're going to find this side of the Southern Hemisphere. It's currently confirmed for Saturday, 28th May. Session voting is open. It's for the community, by the community. The site to go to is www.dddmelbourne.com. Welcome everyone to Talking Shop Down Under. This is your host, Richard Banks. Sit back, enjoy, relax for the next half hour, because we have with us for this particular episode the amazing, the heroic, the ever impressive and irrepressible Jordan Knight.
Hello. Do you introduce everybody that way, or am I?
No, just in the mood I'm in.
You got it's late.
Yeah, if I was in a different mood, I'd be like, here's Jordan.
Again. Is that my first time on Talking Shop?
It is. Welcome. We popped your cherry. So to speak.
So to speak.
All right. So for the listeners who may not have heard you before or encountered any of your awesomeness encased in human form, would you like to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Well, hello, everybody. My name is Jordan, as Richard said, and I'm not nearly as awesome as he may have made out. But anyway, I run my own software company here in Australia called Xamling, and we've been going for a year now. In fact, we're about to hit our year anniversary on the 24th of this month, of April 2011. And we specialize in, I guess, client development. So you're talking in-browser text, Silverlight and HTML and JavaScript and everything like that. Our name Xamling is obviously derived from the word XAML. And when we started the company, we thought, let's do a whole heap of Silverlight stuff. And then we realized that, hey, we're good at other stuff too. And all of a sudden, we're sort of thinking,
Not the best name anymore.
But you know how hard it is to name a company? It's the longer you look at it, the harder it is to actually pick a good name, because, you know, they might be good names if you look at them, you know, for 5 minutes, but all of a sudden you're trying to pick a name over about a week, everything looks crap after that.
So you didn't just go to like the name generator site or something like that, pick something at random?
Oh, it would have been a good idea. Maybe it was a tough struggle.
You could have used a GUID or something, it would have been a unique name.
Yeah. But anyway, here we are. And we've done some interesting stuff this year. We've basically target mainly consumer-focused applications as opposed to enterprise, in that we like to make things that people want to use. And I guess during the – yeah. I mean, that's technically the distinction, right? If you're going to go home and you're going to download something, then I guess that's a consumer-focused app. And it is pretty funny.
And the enterprise app is not.
Yes, exactly. And over the year, like we've not only, I guess, made a heap of these apps, but also looked inside, you know, the type of people and what they're thinking that might drive them to want to actually use an app. And so more recently, we've actually released a couple of, we've done a study on consumer-focused technologies, and I've done a few presentations recently as well on the topic. And it's really funny the things you find when you delve into the, you know, consumer drivers. Mm-hmm. What makes them actually want to go and download something and use it? You know, it's an interesting area, and I think that a lot of people don't, you know, really think about that in a lot of depth.
So this is different to UX.
UX,
or it's kind of a foundation on which UX is built?
It is. So, I mean, user experience, people think of that as really lovely UIs that are intuitive to use, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the most basic level, I guess that's true. And it's funny, though, when you start thinking about UX as something that could possibly transcend a single device. And so, I guess, you know, good UX isn't just... It is far more than just the simple, really nice UI that's easy to use and intuitive. The example of a cross-screen UX would be when you're sitting on the bus and you log into your internet banking, say you're on your iPhone or other mobile device, what you see on the screen is I want to check my balance. I want to maybe transfer some funds.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, a lot of the other features in an internet banking system wouldn't make sense when I'm out on the road, but they probably wouldn't fit on the screen anyway. And so the UX isn't just about the reformatted screen for the mobile device. It's about the things that I want to do there as well. When I get home onto the larger screen, I want to log in. I want to be able to not only transfer cash, but I want to be able to pay bills and maybe export an Excel for my accountant and do all these extra things. So UX isn't just about what the screen looks like. It's about the functionality and I guess what makes sense on whatever device you're working on. And so it's interesting when you're talking to people about, cross-screen experiences and it not just being a reformatted, the same experience, reformatted to work on the smaller screen or the larger screen. It's about what makes sense on that screen. The same thing too, like when you're on a mobile device, for example,
mm-hmm.
it's interesting talking to people when you say, even on a mobile device, you can have multiple levels of user experience. So you have a fleeting interaction where you're walking down the street and you want to check, the next when the time of your next appointment, or you want to check the weather. You want to very quickly tell someone you're going to be late. And these are things that Windows Phone 7 does really well with their live tiles. It's the best example of a fleeting experience that I've seen yet on any mobile device, in that I can be walking down the street and I can flip my phone open and I've got a live tile there that tells me the weather and maybe a bit of a forecast. I can see very quickly the time of my next appointment and I can click that and, click another button and tell people I'm going to be late, all without stopping. So I can integrate that into my movement through the environment very, very quickly. Whereas when I go and sit on the bus, I want a deeper interaction with that device. So I can go and check Facebook, I can upload photos, I can write emails and things like that. So even on a mobile device, there's multiple levels. So there's this cross-device, multiple-level user experience that's out there. And it's really interesting having discussions with people that, I guess, hadn't really thought about that sort of thing.
So this is, I suppose in some respects, this is something that as developers, if we're doing UI design, we generally, I suppose, we think tasks when we want to use something, that whole task-driven UI. But when we tend to write things, we tend to just be, well, what type of data are we actually interested in? And then how do I get that data in and out of the system? And we forget about all that other stuff because it feels like hard work.
I mean, at the end of the day, though, everything I've just talked about isn't really hard work, I guess. It's more having a little think about how you're going to present that data. Like, are you presenting a bunch of features? Are you exposing things that they can do? Or are you creating experience for them to use and be part of? It's just those same features, but I guess put in a certain way.
So is it a case of you've got to have a certain, way of thinking already inbuilt into you, like wired into your head that you're thinking about others? You've got to have that empathy or sympathy thing going on to actually do UI design well, or experience and all these sort of things? Or is it...
Well, to be perfectly clear, UI design is the realm of black magic, and I have no idea about that.
So, okay, ignoring pixel polishing.
Yeah, exactly. No, but UX, though.
Yeah, user experience. Is that something that only certain people really get, and others who don't, is it because of maybe that they don't feel how other people feel, if that makes sense?
I'm
talking about feelings on a technical empathy. Podcast. Oh, my goodness.
So God knows a lot of developers don't have empathy.
No.
But it doesn't really – I don't think it comes down to empathy or necessarily feeling what others feel. I think it comes down to the fact that even as developers or even as consumers of – even as creators of applications, at the end of the day, you yourself are still a consumer of something that somebody has targeted at you. I don't know anybody out there that doesn't use a product or a service that wasn't specifically targeted at them. So, you sit back and think, I'm using this app, like it might be as simple as, hey, I use something like Read It Later or Evernote or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And as a developer, you integrate that into your daily life because you take your notes and things like that. And all of a sudden you realize Read It Later works on all my devices, or Evernote works on all my devices, and there's even an API there should I choose to take it further. And you sort of think, hey, why do I like Read It Later so much? Well, because it works on everything I've got and it fits everything I've got. And so, you know, people shy away from a technology that will bind them to working with it in a particular way. So that could mean something as simple as, hey, I'm not going to use this application or service because it means that I have to sit at my PC at my desk. Because people these days, they're no longer operating in silos. They're never detached from their data. They're never detached from their friends. And that includes if they're on the bus or if they're sitting at their desk at work or anything like that. So, you know, these experiences have to transcend any device they're on or any situation they're in. And, you know, people fall into these patterns without even realizing it.
In terms of developing for that, though, there's got to be some challenges because you've got, you know, I'm looking at my desktop. Well, not my desktop because that died, but I'm looking at my desk at the moment and I've got my laptop here with a screen attached to it. So I've got multiple screens running and then I look next to it and I've got my, you know, my iPhone sitting there and I've got a 3DS sitting over here and I've got, junk everywhere, stuff basically. Everywhere. Technology.
Yeah.
Trying to develop that ubiquitous application that sits at, well, not ubiquitous, probably not right term, but the application that has a front end that runs on each of these devices.
Yeah.
If you're not using pure HTML, you're kind of in a world of hurt, aren't you?
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, you know, we're the Silverlight guys from way back. Alex and I are both Silverlight MVPs, and you know, it's like, hey, we're all about, you know, that platform and targeting platform, and you know, it just always works no matter where you build it, it'll run on everything. But it is interesting,
really?
Now
Silverlight
that
runs on the iPhone.
I'm getting there.
Oh, okay.
But it's interesting because we've actually been doing a bit of HTML5 lately. Now, before Silverlight came out, we were in the world of client development once more, back in JavaScript, back in the day before jQuery and everything like that. And I mean, jQuery was starting to be around, but I mean, we were building advanced JS-based interfaces in IE4 when it came out. And I mean, it's come a hell of a long way. And then we sort of went down Silverlight path and still doing a lot of Silverlight stuff and absolutely loving it. But it's interesting because we've had a few people come up and ask, you know, do you know how to build iPad apps or iPhone apps or anything like that? And we're like, oh, not really. You know, we don't want to dilute and go back in. We don't want to do the Objective-C or, you know, go to Android and do the Java or anything like that. And they're like, oh, well, can you just design us up something and we'll get someone else to do it? Because Alex is a great designer. Plug, plug, plug. but it's interesting because we started thinking, you know, maybe HTML5. I mean, I use the term loosely because it's more about less HTML5, more great JavaScript engines and CSS 3. I mean, let's face it, if we're going to build a really lovely looking consumer-focused app, unless it's a game or something similar, something sort of a little bit out there, you're not going to be using things like Canvas and stuff like that. I mean, those sorts of things, I guess, are it's where people go, hey, HTML5 is like, what tags are you using? It's like, well, we're actually just using
normal tags.
Really lovely CSS 3D transforms and the fact that all of a sudden these browsers, even on mobile devices, have really fantastically fast JavaScript engines. I'm digressing. Yeah, we thought, hey, let's have a go at this. So we had a client that rang us up and said, do you know how to do this stuff? And we thought, well, not really, but I'll tell you what. I said to Alex and another one of our guys, Dan, let's see exactly what we can do on this thing. So we built a demo and we used the hardware acceleration of all the transforms and things in the iPad, and we built a demo, and it was actually, the demo was targeting WebKit, not so much iPad, but you know, targeting the WebKit platform. Mm-hmm. So we went into this client and we did a demo, and they're like, well, that's great. We've seen better demos from the other guys though. You know, obviously there's a couple of other companies in there competing on their native apps. Anyway, we did this this HTML5 demo, but we didn't tell them it was HTML5 until halfway through the meeting. And then we got halfway through and they're like, oh, right, so, you know, it's not it looks great, like, you know, well done, but it's not quite as, you know, these other guys have done this awesome stuff. And so then we told them, hey, no, actually, this is written in HTML. And then we pulled out the Samsung Galaxy Tab and showed them running on that, and showed them it running on the iPhone and everything like that. Showed the same app running in Safari on the desktop. And all of a sudden, they're like, holy hell. You mean to say that we can get this one app and we can target all these devices, you know, without going through the pain, I guess, of having to do cross-browser stuff? Because we're singing the praises of, I guess, targeting WebKit as a platform as opposed to browsers as a platform.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, most of the, you know, all the tablet devices are all based on Android. And I'm going to get to the IE9 phone accelerated stuff in a minute. But it's interesting because when you target WebKit and you target and you use your CSS transforms and things like that, they're all hardware accelerated. You can move stuff around the screen at full frame rate, and people looking at it would not know it's not a native app. It's simply amazing the things that they're doing in these browsers these days. And it's interesting, when I was at the Mix conference last week, and it's interesting talking to people where they're going, oh, native app this and everything like that. And then, like, you know, a lot of the people I've been talking to aren't completely married to things like Silverlight on Windows Phone and everything like that. But, you know, they might be arguing that the NAB conference was on as well. There's a lot of Java developers at it. And, you know, they're like arguing their native thing on their Android and everything like that. And I was basically throwing down the challenge. We can build something that would do exactly the same as what you're doing in the same amount of time in HTML, but it will work on all these devices. And it's like, you know, they call the big BS and everything like that. But I swear to God, it's at the stage now where I think that targeting HTML as the mobile app platform is going to be the way to go in the future. At the moment, iPad 2 is the mm-hmm. tablet. It's what everyone thinks. As soon as you say the word tablet, people start thinking iPad, right?
Yep.
Even though they're not really marketing as a tablet, I don't know. But
no, it's just it's a big iPod Touch, right?
It's a big, yeah. It's a we've all seen the funny Simon Pegg. Hello, ambulance. And he's talking on the iPad. I'm shrinking. But it's funny because you know, and so there's a lot of organizations out there, especially big ones, you know, and the big organizations, iPad's been out for a year, and they're only just starting to think, hey, we need to write some iPad apps. A couple of them sure have them out there, and they're certainly well through their projects. But, you know, they're starting to think, you know, how do we get our brand onto the iPad and everything like that? So they've got these research projects going on internally where they're, you know, they've engaged somebody to build themselves, you know, build them as, you know, proof of concept iPad app and things like that. I'll tell you what, though, you walk into that organization and show them that app running on all these devices, and all of a sudden they start thinking, hey, wait a minute, maybe native isn't such a great value proposition if we can do this in the browser, because they're all hardware accelerated. So, you know, the WebKits are on the iOS and the Android platform, and the new BlackBerry Playbook as well, which is also hardware accelerated. So all of a sudden you get 3-for-1. And HTML being HTML, you know, it resizes really well. So they've all got different screens, but that's something that we've been dealing with since the birth of the internet, right? Like, it's not something new.
Just cutting in a little bit, the whole trying to get the thing to act like a native app on a device and everything else. And if we're talking the i asterisk devices plus a phone 7 and an Android and everything else, how do you pick up things like swipes and, you know, those gesture movements?
It depends on the actual device, but we've been using a library called TouchSwipe, and it's a jQuery plugin. So we're basing everything in jQuery still.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, TouchSwipe, you register, you grab out an element using dollar whatever, and then you register a touch swipe on it. And you pass into it an object literal that with some configuration saying, I'd either like to have a swipe or a tap.
Mm-hmm.
And the swipe can come with a threshold. So if it's under 200, it won't swipe and things like that. And you get callbacks every time the finger moves and things. So you can sort of make it bounce and things. If they let go, you get an event, and you can make it bounce back using your transform. So it's sort of like a double approach, that you get the event that tells you where they swiped and how far it went. And then you go and grab the element that they're swiping on and then run a transform on it. And of course that transform runs in hardware, so it's smooth as anything. So it says, you know, they've swiped 200, 300, 400 pixels in this direction. They're swiping left, or they're swiping up and down. So touch swipe's really good because it says up, down, left, right, or tap.
And so it does pinch and zoom and all those sort of things?
Not sure, to tell you the truth. I haven't looked at pinch and zoom on that. Maybe. I'm not sure. I haven't had to actually do a pinch and zoom scenario yet, but that'd be pretty cool, hey. But anyway, you hook up these swipe fence, and it's it's all jQuery plugin, so it's so easy to use, and you just integrate it straight into your code, and all of a sudden you've got this working UI. And I wrote a little jQuery plugin myself that basically it was mainly to aid with debugging, because on Safari on desktop it doesn't have those same events, you know, the swipe events.
Yep.
I wrote a little jQuery plugin that detected either one, and either if it was a swipe, I'd just do a drag, and if it was actually on the iOS device, it would do the proper swipe and everything like that. And we managed to get some really cool stuff going between that and transforms. So translate, so the WebKit translate 3D stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You have to use translate 3D because that's the only one that runs in hardware. And within an afternoon we had this awesome looking thing. You drag around all over the screen and everything like that. It's seriously easy to do. But
here's the catch.
Well, it's not the catch. It's more, you know, what do you do once you get past that? So what, you can move things around the screen. You still have to think about, an approach to your development in the client, especially when you're coming to JavaScript. Now, through my experience out in the world, and I know this is going to sound a little bit harsh, but
Just say it.
I'm just going to spit it out. There's a lot of JavaScript developers out there. Hello to you all. And I think that JavaScript's the type of language where people are always learning something new, and they're never quite sure the best way to do something, or they're not aware of something that JavaScript can do. In that, I think that whilst a lot of the time developers are like, "Hey, I know JavaScript," there's a lot more depth to it in that. I guess it comes in two levels. People do JavaScript where they, you know, they update some fields and things like that, or they build an entire application in it. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to build an entire application in JavaScript, you need to start thinking about, hey, you know, am I using any kind of pattern or framework? Am I just hacking out code or anything like that? And I sort of, in the past, I've used ASP.NET Ajax and jQuery and things like that. And, you know, it's all too often, especially when I was consulting, you go in and see procedural-based JavaScript, which is a real shame, because JavaScript is the most amazing functional dynamic language. Like, even today, as a Silverlight developer, JavaScript is still my favorite language. And it is a real shame to see procedural JavaScript. I mean, people should be using prototypes, or as we've been actually experimenting with the HJS JavaScript, jQuery plugin. It's just a little plugin that helps you, extrapolate away a little bit from the prototypal nature of JavaScript, and I guess place yourself into more of a class style world.
Okay.
And that mainly, I mean, I love the prototypal nature of JavaScript. But I think for a lot of developers, they like to see the class style. And at the end of the day, HJS is really, really good for that. So you can do inheritance, you can do base types and things like that. You can do properties, you can do methods and local members and you know, all that sort of thing, which JavaScript by default obviously supports, but in a different way. So you don't have to worry about doing your closures to do your, local methods and things like that. It sort of handles all that stuff for you. So it makes JavaScript more accessible for people who like to think in classes as opposed to prototyping and functional dynamic languages. we've been working with that a bit, and also the jQuery template library.
Yep.
which is also really, really amazingly cool. In fact, that was my biggest discovery recently, getting out of the Silverlight world and coming back into the JavaScript world for a bit and seeing just the advances that have been made in that area.
So what does the template library do?
So jQuery template library basically allows you to define a piece of a chunk of HTML with template markup. So you can do things like in your template, you can do like for each item. And then for each of those items, you can say write a div. And in the div, you can use a couple of squiggly brackets to write out a value that might have been in, you know, one of the properties on the items that you're iterating through.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically a really simple way to take an object in JavaScript and marry it up to a template and then have that template displayed on the screen. So, you know, you use a mixture of the HJS and jQuery templating libraries and a couple of other things like maybe the MVP pattern, which seems to work really well with it. And all of a sudden, you want to put, say, five areas on the home screen that are dynamically generated. And each of those areas is one of these templates, but repeated. And then inside each of those areas, you have, say, five fields that you need to write out.
Mm-hmm.
So you just pass into a view controller, hey, here's my five objects. And the view controller iterates through them and it goes and grabs the template for each of those objects and adds them to the target div that it knows about, like some sort of region. And then displays them on screen. And so you get this great separation of views and your models and things like that. But, you know, I was sort of thinking about it a little bit further. I don't think that it was the way that I did it was really, really great. And I'm starting to think, you know, I'm using these templates and I've got this class set up and everything like that, but it just doesn't quite fit. Something's not gelling. And then I came across Knockout.js,
yep.
Which is an MVVM implementation of it's like an MVVM implementation in JavaScript. And it's absolutely fabulous. It's simply an amazing library, which basically uses a mixture of – it's all jQuery-based. So it uses jQuery templates and the HTML5 data tag, which basically in HTML5 you can have – I don't know if you remember, in the IE days, you were able to do what are they called? Abstract properties? No. You could add any property to any tag and then reference it later. It would add it at runtime. It was like a dynamic property sort of thing. But it was unofficial. So, you know, you could go and put on a P tag. You could have P, you know, my data equals something and treat it like a tag in .NET.
Mm-hmm.
But you could put any one on there you want. But in HTML5, you can do data dash. And anything you put into a data dash is known by HTML5 to be basically ignored.
it still counts as valid markup.
It's valid markup. So you can put into these data fields, a JavaScript object literal, for example, and then you can evaluate that at runtime and get like this whole heap of extra data about that element. So you can imagine you can have a select box with a whole heap of options, and the select would be empty, I guess, from server generation,
mm-hmm.
but you put some extra information into its data bind that would configure that select box. You put some extra information into its data field saying, you know, this is this JavaScript object literal that tells whatever framework, like Knockout, for example, whereabouts to go and get that particular data for that select box. And then the framework itself can go and figure that out and populate the select box. And then you can also automatically hook up events and things that tell the UI what to do when a particular item is selected. It sounds really complex, but when you see it in operation, it just makes
applications
amazingly simple to build.
There's a little sample on the Knockout.js page. Just shows how some of that sort of thing fits together.
Yeah, it's just knockoutjs.com, and I would highly recommend it.
All right, so I think we're getting to just about time, as it turns out, towards the end of the episode. So before we go, would you like to do any plugs about anything you're doing? Because you haven't plugged yourself enough yet.
How do people
get in touch, that sort of thing.
we're at xamling.net, so xamling.net.
With a name change competition to come.
Yeah. you know what? We actually held a naming competition when we first started the company. We had nameoursite.com or something, nameourcompany.com. And we had all these awesome ideas, like heaps and heaps of people contributed, but we ended up choosing none of them. So
then maybe you just need to be JSling or something. JSling.
Yeah, something like that. HTML5ling. I'm not sure. not sure if it fits. But that's our site. And we're around, like we hang out, and we're at TechEd and Remix and all those sorts of events. And come and say hello. At JackAj on Twitter, JAKKAJ. If you're wondering, it was the only handle that was available on the internet when I joined it. So the internet's full, Rich. Didn't anyone tell you?
Well, all the IP4 addresses are gone anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Really? The last block's allocated. I don't know if they're all used yet, but the last block's allocated. Anywho, leaving that aside, we'll wrap it up here and say thank you to everyone for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of Talking Shop Down Under. And until then, happy coding. Catch you guys later. Visit talkingshopdownunder.com for previous shows or to subscribe to the feed. Your feedback is always very much appreciated, so get in touch and let us know what you're thinking. Reviews can be left on iTunes or the Zoom Marketplace. Email can be sent to mail@talkingshopdownunder.com and tweets to @talking_shop. That's it for now. Show's over. Go home, people. Go home.